Chapter 4. Even before I'm awake, the alarm clock is in my hand, and I break from sleep completely at the same moment I hurl the clock against the wall. It lets out a final wail before shattering.
Whoa,
Lindsay says when I slide into the car 15 minutes later.
Is there a job opening in the red light district I don't know about?
Just drive. I can barely look at her. Anger is seething through me like liquid. She's a fraud. The whole world is a fraud. One bright, shiny scam. And somehow I'm the one paying for it. I'm the one who died. I'm the one who's trapped. Here's the thing. It shouldn't be me. Lindsay's the one who drives like she's in the real-life version of Grand Theft Auto. Lindsay's the one who's always thinking of ways to punk people or humiliate them, who's always criticizing everybody. Lindsay's the one who lied about being friends with Juliet Sykes and then tortured her all those years. I didn't do anything. I just followed along.
You're gonna freeze, you know.
Lindsay chucks her cigarette and rolls up the window. Thanks, Mom. I flip down the mirror to make sure that my lipstick hasn't smeared. I've folded my skirt over a couple of times so it barely covers my ass when I sit down, and I'm wearing 5-inch platforms that I bought with Allie as a joke at a store that we were pretty sure only caters to strippers. I've kept the fur trim tank top, but I've added a rhinestone necklace, again purchased as a joke one Halloween when we all dressed up as naughty nurses. It says slut in big, sparkly script. I don't care. I'm in the mood to get looked at. I feel like I could do anything right now. Punch somebody in the face, rob a bank, get drunk, and do something stupid. That's the only benefit to being dead. No consequences. Lindsay misses my sarcasm or ignores it.
I'm surprised your parents even let you out of the house like that.
They didn't. Another thing making my mood foul is the 10-minute screaming match I had with my mother before storming out of the house. Even when Izzy went to hide in her room and my father threatened to ground me for life, the words kept coming. It felt so good to scream, like when you pick a scab and the blood starts flowing again. You are not walking out that door unless you go upstairs and put on some more clothing. That's what my mom said. You'll catch pneumonia. More important, I don't want people in school getting the wrong impression about you. And suddenly, it had all snapped inside of me, broken and snapped. You care now? She jerked back at the sound of my voice like I'd reached out and slapped her. You want to help now? You want to protect me now? What I really wanted to say was, where were you 4 days ago? Where were you when my car was spinning off the edge of a road in the middle of the night? Why weren't you thinking of me? Why weren't you there? I hate both of my parents right now for sitting quietly in our house while out in the darkness my heart was beating away all of the seconds of my life, ticking them off one by one until my time was up. For letting the thread between us stretch so far and so thin that the moment it was severed for good, they didn't even feel it. At the same time, I know that it's not really their fault, at least not completely. I did my part too. I did it on 100 different days and in 1,000 different ways, and I know it. But this makes the anger worse, not better. Your parents are supposed to keep you safe.
Jesus, what is your problem?
Lindsay looks at me hard for a second.
You wake up on the wrong side of the bed or something?
For a few days now, yeah. I'm getting really sick of this low half-light, the sky a pale and sickly blue, not even a real blue, and the sun a wet mess on the horizon. I read once that starving people start fantasizing about food, just lying there dreaming for hours about hot mashed potatoes and creamy blobs of butter and steak running red blood over their plates. Now I get it. I'm starved for different light, a different sun. Different sky. I've never really thought about it before, but it's a miracle how many kinds of light there are in the world, how many skies. The pale brightness of spring when it feels like the whole world is blushing, the lush, bright boldness of a July noon, purple storm skies and a green queasiness just before lightning strikes, and
crazy multicolored sunsets that look like someone's acid trip. I should have enjoyed them more. Should have memorized them all. I should have died on a day with a beautiful sunset. I should have died on summer vacation or winter break. I should have died on any other day. Leaning my forehead against the window, I fantasize about sending my fist up through the glass, all the way into the sky and watching it shatter like a mirror. I think about what I'll do to survive all of the millions and millions of days that will be exactly like this one. Two face-to-face mirrors multiplying a reflection into infinity. I start formulating a plan. I'll stop coming to school, and I'll jack somebody's car and drive as far as I can in a different direction every day. East, west, north, south. I allow myself to fantasize about going so far and so fast that I lift off like an airplane, zooming straight up and out to a place where time falls away like sand being blown off a surface by the wind. Remember what I said about hope? Happy Cupid Day! Elodie sings songs when she gets into the tank. Lindsay stares from Elodie back to me.
What is this? Some kind of competition for least dressed?
If you got it, flaunt it. Elodie eyes my skirt as she leans forward to grab her coffee. Forget your pants, Sam. Lindsay snickers. I say, jealous much? Without turning away from the window. What's wrong with her? Elodie leans back.
Someone forgot to take her happy pills this morning.
Out of the corner of my eye, I see Lindsay look back at Elodie and make a face like, leave it. Like I'm a kid who needs to be handled. I think of those old photos where she's standing pressed arm to arm with Juliet Sykes, and then I think of Juliet's head blown open and splattered on some basement wall. Again, the fury returns, and it's all I can do to keep from turning to her and screaming that she's a fake, a liar, that I can see right through her. I see right through you. My heart flips when I remember Kent's words. I know something that'll cheer you up. Elodie starts rummaging around in her bag, looking pleased with herself. I swear to God, Elodie, if you're about to give me a condom right now. I press my fingers to my temples. Elodie freezes and frowns, holding up a condom between two fingers. But it's your present. She looks at Lindsay for support. Lindsay shrugs.
Up to you, she says.
She's not looking at me, but I can tell my attitude is really starting to piss her off. And to be honest, I'm happy about it.
If you want to be a walking STD farm.
You would know all about that. I don't even mean for it to slip out. It just does. Lindsay whips around to face me.
What did you say?
Nothing. Did you say? I didn't say anything. I lean my head against the glass. Elodie's still sitting there with the condom dangling between her fingers.
Come on, Sam. No glove, no love, right?
Losing my virginity seems absurd to me now. The plot point of a different movie, a different character, a different lifetime. I try to reach back and remember what I love about Rob, what I loved about him, but all I get is a random collection of images in no particular order. Rob passing out on Kent's couch, grabbing my arm and accusing me of cheating. Rob laying his head on my shoulder in his basement, whispering that he wants to fall asleep next to me. Rob turning his back on me in sixth grade. Rob holding up his hand and saying, 5 minutes. Rob taking my hand for the first time ever when we were walking through the hall, a feeling of pride and strength going through me. They seem like the memories of somebody else. That's when it really hits me. None of it matters anymore. Nothing matters anymore. I twist around in my seat, reaching back to grab the condom from Elodie. No glove, no love, I say, giving her a tight smile. Elodie cheers.
That's my girl.
I'm turning around again when Lindsay slams on the brakes at a red light. I jet forward and have to reach out one hand to keep from hitting the dash, and then, as the car stops moving, slam back against the headrest.
The coffee in the cup holder jumps its lip and splashes my thigh.
Oops. Lindsay giggles. So sorry.
You really are a hazard. Elodie laughs and reaches around to buckle her seatbelt. The anger I've felt all morning pours out in a rush. What the hell is wrong with you? Lindsay's smile freezes on her face.
Excuse me?
I said, what the hell is wrong with you? I grab some napkins from inside the glove compartment and start wiping off my leg. The coffee's not even that hot. Lindsay had the lid off to cool it, but it leaves a splotchy red mark on my thigh, and I feel like crying. It's not that hard. Red light, stop. Green light, go. I know that yellow might be a little harder for you to grasp, but you'd think with a little practice, you could come to terms with it. Lindsay and Elodie are both staring at me in stunned silence. But I don't stop. I can't stop. This is all Lindsay's fault. Lindsay and her stupid driving. They could train monkeys to drive better than you. So what? What is it? You need to prove you don't give a shit? That you don't care about anything? You don't care about anybody? Tap a fender here, swipe a mirror there. Oops, thank God we have our airbags. That's what bumpers are for. Just keep going, keep driving. No one will ever know. Guess what, Lindsay? You don't have to prove anything. We already know you don't give a shit about anybody but yourself. We've always known. I run out of air then, and for a second after I stop speaking, there's total silence. Lindsay's not even looking at me. She's staring straight ahead, both hands on the wheel, knuckles white from clutching it so tightly. The light turns green and she presses her foot on the accelerator hard. The engine roars, sounding like distant thunder. It takes Lindsay a while to speak, and when she does, her voice is low and strangled sounding.
Where the hell do you get off?
Guys, Elodie pipes up nervously from the back. Don't fight, okay? Just drop it. The anger is still running through me, an electrical current. It makes me feel sharper and more alert than I have in years. I whirl around to face Elodie. How come you never stand up for yourself? I say. She shrinks back a little, her eyes darting between Lindsay and me. You know it's true. She's a bitch. Go ahead, say it.
Leave her out of this, Lindsay hisses.
Elodie opens her mouth and then gives a minute shake of her head. I knew it, I say, feeling triumphant and sick at the same time. You're scared of her.
I knew it. I told you to leave her alone.
Lindsay finally raises her voice.
I'm supposed to leave her alone?
The sharpness, the sense of clarity is disappearing. Instead, everything feels like it's spinning out of my control.
You're the one who treats her like shit all the time. It's you!
Elodie's so pathetic. Look at Elodie climbing all over Steve. He doesn't even like her. Look, Elodie's trashed again. Hope she doesn't puke in my car. Don't want the leather to smell like alcoholic. Elodie draws in a sharp breath on the last word. I know I've gone too far. The second I say it, I want to take it back. My mirror is still flipped down, and I can see Elodie staring out the window, mouth quivering like she's trying not to cry. Number one rule of best friends. There are certain things that you never, ever say. All of a sudden, Lindsay slams on the brakes. We're in the middle of Route 120, about a half mile from school, but there's a line of traffic behind us. A car has to swerve into the other lane to avoid hitting us. Thankfully, there's no oncoming traffic. Even Elodie cries out, Jesus! My heart is racing. The car passes us, honking furiously. The passenger rolls down his window and yells something, but I can't hear it. I just see the flash of a baseball hat and angry eyes. What are you doing? The people in the cars in line behind us start leaning on their horns, too, but Lindsay throws the car in park and doesn't move. Lindsay, Elodie says anxiously, Sam's right. It's not funny. Lindsay lunges for me, and I think she's going to hit me. Instead, she leans over and shoves open the door.
Out,
she says quietly, her voice full of rage. What? The cold air rushes into the car like a punch to the stomach, leaving me deflated. The last of my anger and fearlessness goes with it, and I just feel tired.
Lindsay,
Elodie tries to laugh, but the sound comes out high-pitched and hysterical. You can't make her walk. It's freezing.
Out,
Lindsay repeats. Cars are starting to pull around us now, everyone honking and rolling down their windows to yell at us. All of their words get lost in the roar of the engines and the bleeding of the horns, but it's still humiliating. The idea of getting out now, of being forced to walk in the gutter while all of those dozens of cars roll by me with all those people watching, makes me shrink back against my seat. I look to Elodie for more support, but she looks away. Lindsay leans over.
I said get out,
she whispers, and her mouth is so close to my ear, if you couldn't hear her, you'd think she was telling me a secret. I grab my bag and step into the cold. The freezing air on my legs almost paralyzes me. The second I'm out of the car, Lindsay guns it, peeling away with the door still swinging open. I start walking in the leaf and trash-filled ditch that runs next to the road. My fingers and toes go numb almost instantly, and I stomp my feet on the frost-covered leaves to keep the blood flowing. It takes a minute for the long line of traffic to begin to unwind, and horns are still honking away, the sound like the fading wail of a passing train. A blue Toyota pulls up next to me. A woman leans out, gray-haired, probably in her 60s, and shakes her head.
Crazy girl,
she says, frowning at me. For a moment, I just stand there, but as the car starts to pull away, I remember that it doesn't matter. None of it matters. So I throw up my middle finger, hoping she sees. All the way to school, I repeat it again. It doesn't matter. None of it matters, until the words themselves lose meaning. Here's one of the things I learned that morning. If you cross a line and nothing happens, the line loses meaning. It's like that old riddle about a tree falling in a forest and whether it makes a sound if there's no one around to hear it. You keep drawing a line farther and farther away, crossing it every time. That's how people end up stepping off the edge of the earth. You'd be surprised at how easy it is to bust out of orbit, to spin out to a place where no one can touch you, to lose yourself, to get lost. Or maybe you wouldn't be surprised. Maybe some of you already know. To those people, I can only say, I'm sorry. I skip my first four periods just because I can, and spend a couple of hours walking the halls with no real goal or destination. I almost hope someone will stop me, a teacher or Ms. Winters or a teacher's aide or someone, and ask what I'm doing, even accuse me point blank of cutting and send me to the principal's office. Fighting with Lindsay left me unsatisfied, and I still feel a vague but pressing desire to do something. Most of the teachers just nod or smile, though, or give me a half wave. They have no way of knowing my schedule, no way of knowing whether I have a free period or whether class was canceled, and I'm disappointed by how easy it is to break the rules. When I walk into Mr. Daimler's class, I deliberately don't look at him. But I can feel his eyes on me, and after I slide into my desk, he comes straight over.
It's a little early in the season for beach clothes, don't you think? He grins.
Normally, whenever he looks at me for longer than a few seconds, I get nervous, but today I force myself to keep my eyes on his. Warmth spreads over my whole body. It reminds me of standing under the heat lamps in my grandmother's house when I was no older than 5. It's amazing that eyes can do that, that they can transform light into heat. I've never felt that way with Rob. If you got it, flaunt it, I say, making my voice soft and steady. I see something flicker in his eyes. I've surprised him.
I guess so,
he murmurs, so quietly I'm sure I'm the only one who hears. Then he blushes bright red like he can't believe himself. He nods at my desk, which is empty except for a pen and the small square notebook Lindsay and I use to pass back and forth between classes, writing notes to each other.
No roses today? Or did your bouquet get too heavy to carry around?
I haven't been to any of my classes, so I haven't collected any valigrams. I don't even care. In the past, I would rather have died than be seen in the halls of Thomas Jefferson on Cupid Day without a single rose. In the past, I would have considered it a fate worse than death. Of course, that was before I actually knew. I toss my head, shrugging. I'm kind of over it. It's as though confidence is flowing into me from someone else, someone older and beautiful, like I'm only playing a part. He smiles at me, and again I see something moving in his eyes. Then he goes back to his desk and clasps his hands, gesturing for everybody to take their seats. As always, the dirty hemp necklace is peeking out from under his collar, and I let myself think about looping my fingers through it, pulling him toward me and kissing him. His lips are thick, but not too thick, and shaped exactly how a guy's mouth should be shaped. Like if he just parted his lips at all, your mouth would fit directly on top of it. I think of the picture from his high school yearbook when he's standing with his arm around his prom date. She was thin, long brown hair, even smile. Like me. All right, everyone, he's saying as people shuffle and scrape into their desks, giggling and ruffling their bouquets. I know it's Cupid Day and love is in the air, but guess what? So are derivatives. A couple of people groan. Kent bangs in the door almost late, his bag flapping open and papers literally scattering behind him, like he's Hansel or Gretel and he has to make sure someone can follow his trail of half-completed sketches and notes to math class. His black and white checkered sneakers peek out under his oversized khakis. Sorry, he mutters breathlessly to Mr. Daimler. Emergency at the Tribulation, printer problems. Malignant paper tumor in tray 2, had to operate immediately or risk losing it. As soon as he makes it halfway up the aisle to his seat, his math textbook, which was riding higher and higher on a wave of crumpled paper inside his open bag, pops out and slams to the floor, and everybody laughs. I feel a surge of irritation. Why is he always such a mess? How hard is it to zip up a bag? He catches me looking at him, and I guess he mistakes my facial expression for concern because he grins at me and mouths, "Walking disaster," as though he's proud of it. I turn my attention back to Mr. Daimler. He's standing at the front of the room with his arms crossed, his expression fake serious. That's another thing I like about him. He's never really mad. Glad the printer pulled through, he says, raising his eyebrows. His sleeves are rolled up and his arms are tan, or maybe that's just the color of his skin, like burnt honey. As I was saying, I know there's a lot of excitement on Cupid Day, but that doesn't mean we can just ignore the regular Cupids! Someone squeals and the class dissolves into giggles. Sure enough, there they are, the devil, the cat, and the pale white angel with her big eyes. Mr. Daimler throws up his hands and leans against his desk. I give up, he says. Then he turns his smile to me for just a second, but long enough for my whole body to light up like a Christmas display. The angel delivers three of my roses, the ones from Rob, Terra Flute, and Elodie, and then keeps sorting methodically through her bouquet, flipping each card over and checking for my name. There's something careful and sincere about her movements, like she's super focused on doing everything correctly. As she reads off the addressee, she mouths the name quietly to herself, wonderingly, as though she can't believe there are so many people in the school, so many roses to deliver, so many friends. It's painful to watch, and I stand up abruptly, grabbing the cream and pink rose from her hands. She jumps back, startled. It's mine, I say. I recognize it. She nods at me, wide-eyed. I doubt a senior has ever spoken to her in her life. She begins to open her mouth. I lean in so that no one else can hear me. Don't say it, I say, and her eyes go even wider. I can't stand to hear her say it's beautiful. I can't stand it when the rose and everything else is all garbage now. Meaningless. It's just going in the trash. I mean it, too. As soon as Mr. Daimler ushers the Cupids out the door, everyone in class still giggling and showing off the notes their friends have written them and trying to predict how many roses they can expect by the end of the day, I scoop up my roses and sail to the front of the classroom, dumping them in the big trash can right next to Mr. Daimler's desk. Instantly, the giggling stops. Two people gasp, and Chrissy Walker actually makes the sign of the cross like I've just crapped on a Bible or something. That's how big of a deal the roses are. Becca Roth half rises from her seat like she wants to dive in after the roses and rescue them from the fate of being crushed under paper and pencil shavings, failed quizzes, and empty soda cans. I don't even look in Kent's direction. I don't want to see his face. Becca blurts.
You can't just throw out your roses, Sam. Someone sent those to you.
Yeah, Chrissy pipes up. It's so not done. I shrug. You can have them if you want. I gesture to the trash can, and Becca casts a wistful look in that direction. She's probably trying to decide whether the social boost she would get from having four extra roses is worth the ego hit she would take for dumpster diving to get them. Mr. Daimler smiles, winks at me.
You sure you want to do that, Sam?
He raises upturned hands.
You're breaking people's hearts right and left.
Oh, yeah? All of this will be gone, vanished, erased tomorrow, and tomorrow will be erased the next day, and the next day will be erased after that, all of it wiped clean and spotless. What about yours? It goes dead silent in the room. Somebody coughs. I can tell Mr. Daimler doesn't know whether I'm deliberately baiting him or not. He licks his lips nervously and runs a hand through his hair.
What?
Your heart. I pull myself up so I'm sitting on the corner of his desk, my skirt riding up almost to my underwear. My heart is beating so fast it's a hum. I feel like I'm skimming above the air. Am I breaking it?
Okay. He looks down, fiddles with one of his sleeves. Take a seat, Sam. It's time to get started.
I thought you were enjoying the view.
I lean back a little and stretch my arms above my head. There's a kind of electricity in the air, a zipping, singing tension running in all directions. It feels like the moment right before a thunderstorm, like every particle of air is extra charged and vibrating. A student in the back of the class laughs and another one mutters, "Jesus." Maybe it's my imagination, but I think I recognize Kent's voice. Mr. Daimler looks at me, his face dark.
Sit. If you insist.
I swivel off the edge of the desk and move around to his chair, then sit down and cross my legs slowly, folding my hands in my lap. Little giggles and gasps erupt around the classroom, bursts of sound. I don't know where this is coming from, this feeling of complete and total control. Up until a few months ago, I still turned to jello whenever a guy talked to me, including Rob. But this feels easy, natural, like I've slipped into the skin that belongs to me for the first time in my life.
In your own chair.
Mr. Daimler's practically growling, and his face is dark red, almost purple.
I've made him lose it. Probably a first in Thomas Jefferson history.
I know that in whatever game we're playing, I've just won a point. The idea makes my stomach drop a little, not in a bad way, more like at the moment right before you reach the highest part of the roller coaster, when you know that at any second you'll be at the very top of the park, looking down over everything, pausing there for a fraction of a second, about to have the ride of your life. It's the dip in your stomach right before everything goes flying apart in a blast of wind and screaming, right before you let go completely. The laughter in the room grows to a roar. If you were standing outside, you might mistake it for applause. For the rest of the class, I keep quiet, even though people keep whispering and breaking out into giggles, and I get three notes sent my way. One of them is from Becca and says, "You are awesome." One of them is from Hannah Gordon and says, "He's so hot." Another one lands in my lap, all balled up like trash, before I can see who threw it in my direction. It says, "Whore." For a moment, I feel a hot flush of embarrassment, like nausea or vertigo. But it passes quickly. None of this is real anymore. I'm not even real anymore. A fourth note arrives just before class ends. It's in the form of a miniature airplane, and it literally sails to me,
landing with a whisper on my desk just as Mr. Daimler turns back from writing an equation on the board. It's so perfect, I hate to touch it. But I unfold its wings, and there's a message written in neat block letters.
You're too good for that.
Even though there's no signature, I know it's from Kent. And for a second, something sharp and deep goes through me, something I can't understand or describe. A blade running up under my ribs and making me almost gasp for breath. I shouldn't be dead. It shouldn't be me. I take the note very carefully and tear it in half. Then I tear it in half again. We've been restless all class, and Mr. Daimler gives up 2 minutes before the bell rings.
Don't forget, test on Monday, limits and asymptotes.
He goes to his desk and leans on it, looking tired. There's a mass exhalation, a collective sigh of coats rustling and chairs scraping against the linoleum.
Samantha Kingston, please see me after class.
He's not even looking at me, but the tone of his voice makes me nervous. For the first time, it occurs to me that I could really be in trouble. Not that it matters, but if Mr. Daimler makes me sit through a lecture about responsibility, I'll die of embarrassment. I'll die again.
Good luck,
Becca mouths to me on her way out. We're not even friends. Lindsay calls her the turkey jerk because she eats turkey sandwiches every single day. But the fact that she says it makes the knot ease up in my stomach. Mr. Daimler waits until the last student files out of the classroom. I see Kent hovering at the doorway out of the corner of my eye, and then walks slowly to the door and closes it. Something about the way the door clicks, so final, so quick, makes my heart skip a beat. I close my eyes for a second, feeling like I'm back in the car with Lindsay on Fallow Ridge Road with the misty headlights of a second car bearing down on us in the darkness, an accusation. They always swerve first, she'd said. But at that second, I understand with total and perfect clarity that that's not why she did it, why she does it. She does it for that one thrilling moment when you don't know, when you come up against someone who doesn't swerve and instead find yourself plummeting off the road into the darkness. When I open my eyes, Mr. Daimler has his hands on his hips. He's staring at me. What the hell were you thinking? The harshness in his voice startles me. I've never been cursed at by a teacher. I don't know what you're talking about. My voice comes out sounding thinner, younger than I wanted it to. The shit back there? Right there in front of everybody? What were you thinking? I stand up so I'm not just sitting there looking up at him like a little kid. My legs are wobbly and I have to steady myself with one hand against the desk. I take a deep breath, trying to pull it together. It doesn't matter. All of it will be erased, cleaned away. I'm sorry, I say, feeling a little bit stronger. I really don't know what you're talking about. Did I do something wrong? He looks toward the door and a muscle twitches in his jaw. Just that. That little twitch returns all my confidence. I want to reach out and touch him, put my fingers in his hair. You could get in a lot of trouble, you know, he says, not looking at me. You could get me in a lot of trouble. The first bell rings. Class is officially over now. The singing feeling returns to my blood, to the air. I step carefully around my desk and walk straight to the front of the classroom. I stop when we're only a few feet away from each other. He doesn't back away. Instead, he finally looks at me. His eyes are so deep and full of something, it almost frightens me off. But it doesn't. I lean casually against Becca's desk, tipping backward and resting on my elbows so I'm totally laid out in front of him, chest, legs, everything. My head feels like it has floated away from my body. My body feels like it has floated away from my blood, like I'm just dissolving into energy and vibration. I don't mind trouble, I say in my sexiest voice.
Mr. Daimler is staring into my eyes, not looking at the rest of me, but somehow I know that it's an effort.
What are you doing?
My skirt is riding so high I know my underwear is showing. It's a pink lace thong, one of the first I've ever owned. Thongs always make me feel like there is a rubber band up my butt, but last year, Lindsay and I bought the same pair at Victoria's Secret and swore to wear them. The words come to me from a script from a movie. I can stop if you want. My voice comes out breathy, but not because I'm trying. I am no longer breathing. Everything, the whole world, freezes in that moment while I wait for his response. But when he speaks, he sounds tired, annoyed, not at all what I was expecting.
What do you want, Samantha?
The tone of his voice startles me, and for a second my mind spins blankly. He's staring at me with a look of impatience now, as if I've just asked him to change my grade. The second bell rings. I feel like at any moment he'll dismiss me, remind me about the quiz on Monday. I somehow lost control of the situation, and I don't know how to fix it. The vibration in the air is still there, but now it feels ominous, like the air is full of sharp things getting ready to drop. I want you. I don't mean for it to come out so uncertain. This is what I want. This is what I've been wanting, Mr. Daimler. My mind keeps spinning in a blind panic, and I can't remember his first name, and I feel like laughing hysterically. I'm stretched out half-naked in front of my math teacher, and I don't know his name. Then it comes to me. Evan. I want you, Evan, I say a little more boldly. It's the first time I've ever used his first name. He stares at me for a long time. I start to get nervous. I want to look away or pull down my skirt or cross my arms, but I force myself to stay still. What are you thinking about? I finally ask. But instead of answering, he just walks straight to me and puts his arms on my shoulders, pushing me backward so I tip over onto Becca's desk. Then he's bending over me, kissing me, and licking my neck and ear and making little grunting noises that remind me of Pickle when he has to pee. Pressed against him, I feel tiny. His arms are strong, groping all over my shoulders and arms. He slides one hand up my shirt and squeezes my boobs, one after the other, so hard I almost cry out. His tongue is big and fat. I think, I'm kissing Mr. Daimler, I'm kissing Mr. Daimler. Lindsay will never believe it. But it doesn't feel anything like I've imagined. His 5 o'clock shadow is rough on my skin, and I have this horrible thought that this is what my mom feels when she kisses my dad. When I open my eyes, I see the plain speckled ceiling tiles of the classroom, the ceiling tiles I've spent hours and hours staring at this semester, and my mind starts circling around them, counting, like I'm a fly buzzing somewhere outside my body. I think, how can the same ceiling still be here while this is happening? Why isn't the ceiling coming down? All of a sudden, it's not fun anymore. All those sharp, glittery things drop out of the air at once, and at the same time, something drops deep inside of me. I feel like I'm sobering up after drinking all night. I put my hands on his chest and try to push him off, but he's too heavy, too strong. I can feel his muscles under my fingertips. He used to play lacrosse in high school, Lindsay and I found out, and above that, a fine layer of fat. He's leaning on me with his full weight, and I can't breathe. I'm crushed underneath him, my legs split apart on either side of his hips, his stomach warm and fat and heavy on mine. I wrestle my mouth away from his. We can't do this, here. The words just pop out without my meaning them to. What I wanted to say was, we can't do this, not here, not anywhere. What I wanted to say was, stop. He's breathing hard, still staring at my mouth. There's a tiny bead of sweat at his hairline, and I watch it trace its way across his forehead and down to the tip of his nose. Finally, he pulls away from me, rubs his hand over his jaw, and nods. The moment he's off me, I scrabble up to my feet and tug down my skirt, not wanting him to see that my hands are shaking.
You're right, he says slowly.
He gives a quick shake of his head as though trying to rouse himself from sleep.
You're right.
He takes a few steps backward and turns his back to me. For a second, we just stand there, not speaking. My brain is all static. He's only a few feet away from me, but he looks hopelessly, impossibly far, like someone you can just make out distantly. A silhouette in the middle of a blizzard.
Samantha.
Finally, he turns back to me, rubbing both eyes and sighing like I've exhausted him.
Listen, what happened here? I don't think I need to tell you that this has to stay strictly between you and me.
He's smiling at me, but it's not his normal, easy smile. There's no humor in it.
This is important, Samantha.
You understand? He sighs again.
Everyone makes mistakes.
He trails off watching me. Mistakes. I repeat, the word pinging around in my head. I'm not sure whether he thinks he made a mistake or I did. Mistake, mistake, mistake. A strange word, stinging, somehow. Mr. Daimler's mouth, eyes, nose, his whole face seems to be rearranging itself into unfamiliar patterns, like a Picasso painting.
I need to know that I can count on you.
Of course you can. I hear myself say, and he looks at me, relieved. Like if he could, he would pat me on the head and say, good girl. After that, I just stand there for a bit. I'm not sure if he's going to come around and kiss me or give me a hug. It seems insane just to leave, to pick up my stuff and go as though nothing's happened. But after he blinks at me for a bit, he finally says, you're late for lunch. And now I know I really am being dismissed, so I grab my bag and go. As soon as I'm out in the hall, I lean up against a wall, grateful for the feeling of the stone against my back. Something bubbles up inside me, and I don't know whether I should jump up and down or laugh or scream. Fortunately, the halls are empty. Everybody's already at lunch. I take out my phone to text Lindsay, but then I remember that we're in a fight. There's no text from her asking if I want to go to Kent's party. She must still be mad. I'm not sure whether I'm fighting with Elodie, too. Remembering what I said in the car makes me feel horrible. I think about texting Allie. I'm pretty sure she's not mad at me, at least. And I spend a long time trying to figure out how to word it. It feels weird to write, I kissed Mr. Daimler. But if I write Evan, she won't know who I'm talking about. Evan Daimler feels wrong, too, and besides, we did more than just kiss. He was on top of me. In the end, I drop my phone back into my bag without writing anything. I figure I'll just wait until I've made up with Lindsay and Elodie and tell them in person. It'll be easier that way, easier to make it sound better than it was, and I'll get to see their faces. The thought of how jealous Lindsay will be makes the whole thing more than worth it. I put some concealer on my chin to cover the red spots where Mr. Daimler's face gave me an exfoliation I didn't need, and then I head to lunch. You can't judge a book by its steel-toed combat boots. When I march into the cafeteria 10 minutes late, our usual table is empty, and I know that I have been officially and deliberately ditched. For a fraction of a second, I can feel everyone's eyes lift in my direction, staring. I bring my hand up to my face without meaning to, suddenly terrified that everyone will see the rawness on my chin and know what I've been doing. I duck out into the hall again. I need to be alone. I need to pull it together. I head for the bathrooms, but as I get close, two sophomores, Lindsay calls them s'mores because they're always stuck together and more than two will get you sick, come bursting out of the door giggling, arm in arm. Lunch is prime bathroom traffic time. Everyone needs to reapply lip gloss, complain about feeling fat, threaten to upchuck in one of the stalls. And the last thing I need right now is a steady stream of stupid. I head to the old bathroom at the far end of the science wing. Hardly anyone uses it since a newer bathroom with toilets that don't clog 24/7 was installed last year between the labs. The farther I get from the cafeteria, the more the roar of voices drops away until they sound just like the ocean from far away. I get calmer with every step. My heels beat a steady rhythm on the tile floor. The science wing is empty, as expected, and smells, as always, like chemical cleaners and sulfur. Today, there's something else, though. The smell of smoke and something earthier, more pungent. I push against the bathroom door, and for a second, nothing happens. I push harder, and there's a grating sound. I jam my shoulder against the door, and finally it swings open, carrying me inside with it. Instantly, I hit my knee on a chair that has been propped up against the doorknob, and pain shoots up my leg. The smell in the bathroom is much stronger. I drop my bag and lean over, clutching my knee. Shit! What the hell? The voice makes me jump. I didn't realize there was anyone else in the bathroom. I look up and Anna Cartulo's standing there, holding a cigarette in one hand. Jesus, I say. You scared me. I scared you? She leans up against the counter and taps her ashes in the sink. You, like, forced your way in. Don't you know how to knock? Like I've just broken into her house. Sorry I ruined your party. I make a half-hearted move for the door. Wait. She holds up a hand looking nervous. Are you gonna tell? Tell what? About this. She inhales and blows a cloud of smoke. The cigarette she's smoking is extra thin and it looks like she rolled it herself. Then it hits me. It's a joint. The weed must be mixed with a lot of tobacco because I didn't recognize the smell immediately, and I come home with my clothes reeking of it after every party. Elodie once said it was lucky my mom never came into my room, or she would think I was dealing pot out of my dirty laundry hamper. So what? You just come in here and smoke your lunch? I'm not saying it to be mean, but it comes out that way. Her eyes dart to the floor for a second, and then I notice an empty sandwich bag and a half-eaten bag of chips sitting on the tiles. It occurs to me I've never once seen her in the cafeteria. She must eat her lunch here every day. Yeah, I like the decor. She sees me looking at the sandwich bag, stubs out the joint, and crosses her arms. What are you doing here anyway? Don't you have... She stops herself, but I know what she's about to say. Don't you have friends? I had to pee, I say. This is obviously a lie, since I've made zero effort to use the toilet, but I'm too tired to come up with a different excuse, and she doesn't ask me for one. We stand there in awkward silence for a bit. I've never spoken a word to Anna Cartulo in my life, at least in the life I had before the car crash, beyond one time when I said, "Don't call her an evil wench," after she called Lindsay an evil wench. But I'd rather stay here with her than go out into the hall. Finally, I think, screw it, and I sit down in the chair and prop my leg up on one of the sinks. Anna's eyes are slightly unfocused now, and she's more relaxed, slouching up against one of the walls. She nods at my knee. Looks swollen. Yeah, well, somebody stuck a chair right inside the door. She starts giggling. She's definitely stoned. Nice shoes. She raises her eyebrows at my feet, which are dangling over one of the circular sinks. I can't tell if she's being sarcastic. Hard to walk in, huh? I can walk, I say too quickly. Then I shrug. Short distances, anyway. She snorts and then covers her mouth. I bought them as a joke. I don't know why I feel the need to defend myself to Anna Cartulo, but I guess nothing is the way it's supposed to be today. All the rules have pretty much gone out the window. Anna's relaxing, too. She acts like it's not weird that we're hanging out in a bathroom the size of a prison cell when we should be at lunch. She hops up on the counter and wiggles her feet in my direction. Unsurprisingly, she's not wearing anything Cupid Day related. She has on a couple of layered black tank tops and an open hoodie. Her jeans are fraying at the hem and have a safety pin through the fly where they're missing a button. She's wearing enormous wedge round-toe boots that kind of look like Doc Martens on crack. You need a pair of these. She clicks her heels together, a punked-out Dorothy trying to get home from Oz. Most comfortable shoes I ever owned. I look at her like, yeah, right. She shrugs. Don't knock 'em till you try 'em. Okay, then. Pass 'em over. Anna looks at me for a long second like she's not sure if I'm serious. Look, I kick my shoes off. They hit the ground with a clatter. We'll trade.
Anna bends over wordlessly, unzips her boots, and wiggles out of them. Her socks are rainbow-striped, which surprises me. I would have expected skulls or something. She peels these off next and balls them up in one hand, starting to pass them to me.
Ew!
I wrinkle my nose. No, thank you. I'd rather go commando. She shrugs, laughing.
Whatever.
When I zip into her boots, I realize she's right. They are super comfortable, even without socks. The leather is cool and very soft. I admire them on my feet. I feel like I should be terrorizing children. I knock the bulging steel-tipped toes together, which makes a satisfying clicking sound.
I feel like I should be turning tricks.
Anna has maneuvered her way into my heels and is now teetering experimentally around the bathroom, arms out like she's on a tightrope. Same size feet, I point out, though it's obvious.
8 1/2. Pretty common.
She glances over her shoulder at me like she's considering saying something else, then reaches under the sink and pulls out her bag. A beat-up patchwork hobo thing that looks like she made it herself. She extracts a small Altoids tin. Inside, there's a dime bag of weed. I guess Alex Lament is good for something. Rolling papers and a few cigarettes. She starts rolling another spliff, carefully balancing her life studies packet on her lap to use as a tray. Side note, so far I've seen the life studies packet used as 1, an umbrella, 2, a makeshift towel, 3, a pillow, and now this. I have never actually seen anyone study with it, which either means that everyone who graduates from Thomas Jefferson will be totally unprepared for life, or that certain things can't be learned in bullet point format. Her fingers are thin and move quickly. She's obviously had practice. I wonder if that's what she and Alex do together after they've had sex. Just lie there, side by side, smoking. I wonder if she ever thinks about Bridget when they're doing it. I'm tempted to ask.
Stop staring at me, she says without looking up.
I'm not. I tilt my head back and stare at the vomit-colored ceiling, am reminded of Mr. Daimler and look back at her. There aren't too many other options.
No one asked you to come in here.
Some of the edge returns to her voice. Public property. There's a split second when her face goes dark, and I'm sure she's going to freak out and this will be the end of our shiny, happy time together. I rush on. It's seriously not that bad in here. For a bathroom, you know. She looks at me suspiciously, like she's sure I'm only baiting her so I can make fun of her afterward. You could get some pillows for the floor. I look around, decorate a bit or something. She ducks her head, concentrating on her fingers.
There's this artist I've always liked. The guy who does all the stairs going up and down at the same time.
M.C. Escher? She glances up, obviously surprised I know who she's talking about.
Yeah, him.
A smile flits across her face. I was thinking of, I don't know, hanging one of his prints in here, just taping it up, you know, for something to look at. I have, like, 10 of his books in my house, I blurt out, glad she's not going to stay mad and kick me out of the bathroom. My dad's an architect. He's into that stuff. Anna rolls up the joint, licks the seam, and finishes it off with a few twists of her fingers. She nods at the chair.
If you're going to sit in that, you can at least block the door. That way it's private property.
The chair grates against the tile floor as I scoot backward against the door and both of us wince, catch ourselves wincing and laugh. Anna pulls out a purple lighter with flowers on it, not the lighter I expected of her, and tries to spark the joint. The lighter sputters a few times and she throws it down, cursing. The next time she rummages through her bag, she pulls out a lighter in the shape of a naked female torso. She presses on the head, and little blue flames come shooting out the nipples. Now that is the kind of lighter I would expect Anna Cartullo to have. Anna's face gets serious, and she takes a long pull of the joint, then stares at me through the cloud of blue smoke.
So, she says, why do you guys hate me?
Of all the things I expected her to say, it's not this. Even more unexpected, she holds the spliff out in my direction, offering me some. I hesitate for only a second. Hey, just because I'm dead doesn't mean I'm a saint.
We don't hate you.
It doesn't come out convincingly. The truth is, I'm not sure. I don't hate Anna, really. Lindsay's always said she does, but it's hard to know what Lindsay's reasons are for anything. I take a hit off the joint. I've only smoked weed once before, but I've seen it done 100 times. I inhale and my lungs are full of smoke, a heavy taste like chewing on moss. I try to hold my breath the way you're supposed to, but the smoke tickles the back of my throat. I start coughing and hand the joint back.
Then what's the reason?
She doesn't say, for all the shitty things you've done. For the bathroom graffiti, for the fake email blast sophomore year, Anna Cartullo has chlamydia. She doesn't have to. She passes the joint back to me. I take another hit. Already things are warping, certain objects blurring and others sharpening, like someone's messing with the focus on a camera. No wonder people still talk to Alex, even though he's a douche. He deals good stuff.
I don't know.
Because it's easy.
I guess you need to take things out on somebody.
The words are out of my mouth before I realize they're true. I take another hit and pass the joint back to Anna. I feel like everything's been amplified, like I can feel the heaviness of my arms and legs and hear my heart pumping and blood tumbling through my veins. And at the end of the day, it will all be silenced. At least until time skips back on its wheel and starts again. The bell rings, lunch is over. Anna says, "Shit, shit, I have to be somewhere," and begins trying to gather up her stuff. She accidentally knocks over the Altoids tin, the bag of weed goes flying under the sink, and the papers flit and flutter everywhere. "Shit!" "I'll help," I say. We both get down on our hands and knees. My fingers feel numb and bloated, and I'm having trouble peeling the papers off the ground. This strikes me as hilarious, and Anna and I both start laughing, leaning on each other, gasping for breath. She keeps saying "shit" at intervals. "Better hurry," I say. All of the anger and pain from the past few days is lifting, leaving me feeling free and careless and happy. "Alex will be pissed." She freezes. Our foreheads are so close we're almost touching.
"How did you know I was meeting Alex?"
she says. Her voice is clear and low. I realize too late that I've screwed up. "Seen you sneaking back through Smoker's Lounge after 7th once or twice," I say vaguely, and she relaxes.
"You're not gonna tell anyone, are you?"
she asks, biting her lower lip.
"I wouldn't want..."
She stops herself, and I wonder if she's going to say something about Bridget, but she just shakes her head and continues gathering up the papers, working quickly now. The idea of telling on Anna Cartullo for sleeping with Alex after what I've just done, after Mr. Daimler, is hilarious. I've got no right to say anything to anybody. I'm smoking weed in a bathroom. I have no friends. My math teacher stuck his tongue down my throat. My boyfriend hates me because I won't sleep with him. I'm dead, but I can't stop living. The absurdity of everything really hits me in that second, and I start laughing again. Anna's gotten serious. Her eyes are big, bright marbles.
"What?"
she says.
"Are you laughing at me?"
I shake my head, but I can't respond right away. I'm laughing too hard to breathe. I've been kind of squatting next to her, but I'm shaking so hard, the laughter heaving through me, that I tumble backward, landing on my butt with a loud thump. Anna cracks a smile again.
"You're crazy,"
she says, giggling. I take a few gasping breaths.
At least I don't barricade myself in bathrooms. At least I don't get stoned off half a joint. At least I don't sleep with Alex Lament. At least I don't have bitchy friends. At least I have friends.
We're going back and forth, laughing harder and harder. Anna cracks up so hard she bends to the side and supports herself on one elbow. Then she rolls over all the way so she's just lying there on the bathroom floor making these hilarious yelping noises that remind me of a poodle. Every so often she snorts, which just makes me go off again.
"Let me tell you something,"
I say, as soon as I can get the words out.
"Hear, hear."
Anna pretends to pound a gavel and then snorts into her palm. I love the feeling of thickness around me. I'm swimming in murk. The green walls are water. I kissed Mr. Daimler. As soon as I say it, I die laughing again. Those must be the four most ridiculous words in the English language. Anna heaves herself up on one elbow. You did what? Shh. I bob my head up and down. We kissed. He put his hand up my shirt. He put his hand. I gesture between my legs. She shakes her head from side to side. Her hair whips around her face, reminding me of a tornado. No way, no way, no way. I swear to God. She leans forward so close I can smell her breath on my face. She's been sucking on an Altoid. That is sick. You know that, right? I know. Sick, sick, sick. He went to high school here, like 10 years ago. 8, we checked. She lets out a loud howl of laughter, and for a second, she lays her head down on my shoulder. They're all perverts, she says. The words quiet and directed straight into my ear. Then she pulls away and says, shit, I am so dead. She stands up, steadying herself with one hand on the wall. She teeters for a moment as she stands in front of the mirror, smoothing down her hair. She takes a small bottle from her back pocket and squeezes a couple of drops into each eye. I'm still on the floor, staring up at her from below. She seems to be miles and miles away. I blurt out, you're too good for Alex. She's already stepped over me and on her way out the door. I see her back stiffen, and I think she's going to be angry. She pauses, one hand resting on the chair. But when she turns around, she's smiling. You're too good for Mr. Daimler, she says, and we both crack up again. Then she shoves the chair out of the way and tugs the door open, slipping into the hall. After she's gone, I sit with my head back, enjoying the way the room feels like it's doing loops. This is what it's like to be the sun, I think. And then I think how stoned I am. And then I think how funny it is to know that you're stoned, but not be able to stop thinking stoned thoughts. I see something white peeking out from underneath the sink. A cigarette. I lean down and find another one. Anna forgot to pick them up. Just then, there's a sharp knock on the door, and I snatch both cigarettes up and get to my feet. As soon as I stand, the circling and the feeling of being underwater gets worse. It seems to take me forever to push the chair out of the way. Everything is so heavy. You forgot these, I say, holding the cigarettes up between two fingers as I open the door. It's not Anna, though. It's Ms. Winters, standing in the hallway with her arms crossed and her face pinched up so tightly it looks like her nose is a black hole and the rest of her face is getting slowly sucked into it. Smoking on school property is forbidden, she says, pronouncing each word carefully. Then she smiles, showing all of her teeth. The pugs. In the Thomas Jefferson High School R&R, Rules and Regulations Handbook, it says that any student caught smoking on school property is subject to 3 days suspension. I know this by heart because all the smokers like to tear this page out of the handbook and burn it at the lounge, sometimes crouching and sticking their cigarettes in the flames to catch a light, as the words on the page curl and blacken and smoke into nothing. But I get off with only a warning. I guess the administration makes exceptions for students who have dirt on a certain vice principal and a certain gym teacher slash soccer coach slash mustache fan. Ms. Winters looked like she was going to have a massive coronary when I started going off about role models and my poor impressionable mind. I love that expression, as though everyone under the age of 21 has all the brain power of dental plaster. And the administration's responsibility to set an example, especially when I reminded her about page 69 in the R&R, it is forbidden to engage in lewd or sexually inappropriate acts in or around school property.
That one I know because the page has been torn out and hung up about 1,000 times in various bathrooms on campus, the margins decorated with drawings of a decidedly lewd and sexually inappropriate nature. The administration was totally asking for it, though. Who puts a rule like that on page 69? At least the hour and a half I spent with Ms. Winters has sobered me up. The last bell has just rung, and all around me, students are sweeping out of classrooms, making way more noise than is necessary, shrieking, laughing, slamming lockers, dropping binders, shoving one another, a jittery, mindless, restless noise unique to Friday afternoons. I'm feeling good and powerful, and I'm thinking, I have to find Lindsay. She won't believe it. She'll die laughing. Then she'll put her arm around my shoulder and say,
"You're a rock star, Samantha Kingston."
And everything will be fine. I'm keeping an eye out for Anna Cartullo, too. While I was sitting in Ms. Winter's office, it occurred to me that we never switched shoes again. I'm still wearing her monster black boots.